You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. One almost universal in human history is that people in countries around the world seem to be really prone to a sweet tooth.
From rugula in Eastern Europe to mochi in Japan, tres leches cake in Mexico, and, of course, American apple pie, sugar leaves a cultural imprint wherever you go. Over the centuries, it's also inspired jaw-dropping art and spurred technological advances.
Yet there are parts of sugar's history that are bittersweet. Over the past centuries, its story detours through slavery and environmental degradation to its role in a lot of health problems.
Joining us now is Dara Goldstein, a food writer and founding editor of Gastronomica, the Journal of Food and Culture. She's the editor of the Oxford Companion to Sugar and Sweets. Dara, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks. I'm glad to be talking to you.
So there is a lot to say, obviously, about sugar, a lot to know. This anthology is 900 pages long. Why devote so much space to the topic of sugar and sweets?
You know, it's fascinating. I see the book, having worked on it for so long, as really a compendium of human desire, human pleasure, and human pain. It encompasses our evolution, history and culture, and all through the lens of the sweet. When I think about, there's really, it's hard to think of another foodstuff that has had so much impact on civilization.
Well, what is it about sugar that makes it so attractive to us humans?
Well, it started out just with our evolution. Foods that were ripe and that had a sweet taste were almost assuredly not going to be toxic. So we developed this taste for the sweet and an aversion to the bitter. And that taste, once we had more access to sweet things, it just kept burgeoning. But it also, in the early years, sugar was seen as a medicine, and it was prescribed as such. I mean, it's been a total shift when you think about how we consider it today.
These days, we talk about sugar sometimes in the language of addiction. Do we know what happens in the brain when the brain experiences sugar?
It's fascinating. Sugar itself is not inherently addictive, but it's the refining process that causes the problem. So you can think by analogy of the coca leaf that produces cocaine when it's very highly refined and turned into this powder. If you take a fresh coca leaf and you brew some tea with it, you get a nice little buzz, but it's not dangerous. But the highly refined form of it goes right to the brain, and there are the pathways that it takes to our pleasure receptors. And the same sort of thing happens with sugar. So if you nibble on some sugar cane, if you've ever done that, it's quite lovely, but you're not going to get ill from that. But if you have white sugar and have teaspoonful after teaspoonful, it's going to start doing some damage.
So our natural desire to eat sugar wouldn't be so bad if we were just picking the occasional fruit off the tree to get our sweetness fix. But that desire plus a marketplace packed with refined sugar products, that's where we start to run into trouble?
Yes, that's really what the issue is. And this didn't happen until pretty much the late 19th century with industrialization and also the discovery of processing beets for sugar. It became much less expensive to be able to get sugar, and then it started flooding the marketplace and becoming much cheaper.
And these days we're talking about a world where sugar is almost considered a vice, but was there a time when it was really considered more of a virtue?
Yes, it did start out as a medicine. If you look at Ayurvedic medicine in India or in China, where in both cases it was seen as a substance that created warmth and heat for the body and also encouraged fluidity so that all of your juices were flowing well. And this continued into Western culture as well through humoral medicine, where sugar was often prescribed for people who were phlegmatic or who were not feeling well. So over the centuries, it was used as comfort, which is a word that I love. I would love for it to be brought back into contemporary usage in English. But these are the kinds of seeds like caraway or fennel. You know, when you go to an Indian restaurant and you have sugar-coated seeds at the end, that goes right back to the idea of a little bit of sugar and these spices, and it's very good for the digestion.
We're talking with Dara Goldstein about the history and culture of sugar and sweets. And Dara, speaking of medicine, there's an entry in the book about something called a sugar of lead that was used medicinally.
Oh, yes. Well, it's really kind of crazy because that was the 19th century, what turned out to be rather a quack medicine, because it contained lead. And it didn't really contain sugar. It just had a very sweet flavor. And so it was often prescribed for people with stomach problems until they realized that it was causing more problems than not.
Do we know when sugar began to be popularized? When you would think of not just the ruling classes, but the average person had access to sugar and what it tasted like to them then?
Yeah, I think that the best case for us to understand is looking at late 19th century England. And you could look at Sidney Mintz's wonderful book, Sweetness and Power, and he wrote the introduction to this Oxford Companion. And he looked at the drop in sugar prices and how suddenly what had been this incredible luxury item for the affluent and aristocrats who had beautiful, beautiful constructions made out of sugar to decorate their tables. Suddenly, they were able to put sugar into their tea. They could use sugar to have jam. It is a wonderful preservative, and so that was a way of keeping fruits fresh. And then they started to feel that they were having a taste of luxury as well. But if you track the health of the working classes in England from the time they started imbibing more sugar because they were drinking a lot of tea, their health really began to suffer from it because it gives the satisfaction, and they didn't feel that they needed to eat as many other things because they were feeling more satisfied from the sugar.
That's the downside on the consumer side. As we mentioned up front there was also a big downside on the producer side. Slavery in the history of sugar production and even post-slavery, poor working conditions up to this day, as I understand it.
Yeah, it's really one of the things that was important to me in putting together this volume was to revel in the pleasure and the delight that the sweet brings to us, but not to forget the dark side of it, because when I said earlier that sugar has to do with the rise of civilization, then slavery, unfortunately, is a real case in point. In the United States, we tend to think of slaves on cotton plantations, but worldwide, many more were employed in growing sugar cane, and it was really brutal work because those canes have very, very sharp fibers. And there were also dangers with working in the refineries when there could be explosions. And even after slavery ended, a lot of children were employed in candy factories. I'm in Chicago at the moment, and Chicago is home to Cracker Jacks, which, you know, are this wonderful, iconic American candy. But in the early 20th century, it was found that they were employing children to make candy. And today the big problem is in places like Ivory Coast and Ghana, where very small children are sent out to harvest cacao, the pods that eventually turn into the chocolate that we know. So it's still an issue that's with us.
And you referred earlier to sugar being sort of the delight of the elite. And could you talk about how it was used sort of more whimsically as we go along?
Yes. Beautiful, beautiful sculptures are made out of sugar. You can make a kind of paste with it and either mold it or shape it into turrets or castles or ships or whatever fancy you might have, mythological animals. And these decorated the tables of the European elite. In Turkey, in the Ottoman Empire, the Sultan really loved sugar sculptures, and he would every year have a sugar procession in which hundreds of janissaries would carry beautiful sculptures for the pleasure and delight of the Sultan. Today, sugar is being used in 3D printing to make some really interesting sculptures. And there are some new kinds of uses in what I guess I would call bio-couture, where they're making fabric from lightly sweetened green tea that they allow some bacteria to grow on, and it turns into a kind of solid sheet, and then they dry it, and they can actually stitch it, and you can wear your sugar.
We're talking about all things sweet, the history, the culture, and the dark side of sugar, and we'd like to hear about your relationship with sugar. Do you have a favorite sugar fix? Maybe there's a strong cultural connection for you with sugar, or do you have a love-hate relationship with it? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We'll continue our conversation with food writer Dara Goldstein, who edited the new Oxford Companion to Sugar and Sweets.
We're talking about sugar, its history, its culture, and more. And you can join the conversation. Why are sugar and sweets so alluring, if not addictive? And maybe you have a memory of a favorite childhood treat, maybe a guilty pleasure. Or do you think that sugar does more harm than it does good? And what healthy alternatives have you found? You can call us with your questions about the history of sugar, your questions at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or send an email to talk@WPR.org. You can also post on the Central Time Facebook page.
Food writer Dara Goldstein stays with us. She is the editor of the Oxford Companion to Sugar and Sweets. Now, Dara, how do you approach sugar now after doing this project? Because on one hand, yummy treats. On the other hand, a lot of downside in health and humanity here. What is your relationship with sugar after this project is done?
I have quite a sweet tooth, but now I can't sort of unequivocally look at pastry the way I once did because I have all of these other thoughts in my head. I still enjoy the artistry. I think there are so many extraordinary culinary creations that have come out of working with this amazing substance that is sugar. And I basically approach it the way I do most things in my life, that it's important to indulge and give oneself pleasure. But to remember that life isn't entirely about constant indulgence, and that's how you have to find the balance.
Now, there's a cultural link with sugar, and if you look at, say, literature, children's literature, and childhood in general seem to have a close association with sugar, which is it's a difficult thing now. But do you know anything about how that association between sweet stuff, sugar and spice and everything nice, you know, in childhood came to be?
Well, it's interesting. There is an entire entry on sweets in children's literature. I think for many of us, the moment that comes most immediately to mind is the gingerbread house in Hansel and Gretel. But it's very instructive because the children, of course, are drawn to that which they don't have, this amazing, magical house that is made up of all of these delicious flavors, but inside is this witch. So it's a very cautionary tale. And Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory is another one where it's all about fantasy and the things that you can't get. So I think it is allowing children to soar in their imaginations, but usually at the end, there's a way in which they're brought back to reality.
We're taking your calls and questions about sugar, sweetness, and our relationship to them. You can join in at 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page where we heard from Brad. Brad says, when it comes to sugar, I avoid it and don't really miss it. My tongue is super sensitive to sugar now. A sweet potato, plain, tastes very sweet now. Sugar, not fat, contributes most to obesity and heart disease, Brad says. And I can kind of relate. As you know, Veronica, I love my daily cookie. But, you know, things like carrots, if I put those in a smoothie or just cook them just right, there's a lot of super sweet food out there without going to some kind of pastry or cookie or something like that. Can we train our palates to get more out of less unhealthy stuff, Dara?
Absolutely. I really think it's in the past 50 to 60 years that the American palate has been pretty much destroyed by having so much additional sugar put into refined foods. So if you go for those ripe, and the problem is that so many of the fruits that we get are not fully ripe if you're buying them at the grocery store. But if you taste these beautiful fruits and vegetables that come right out of the ground when they're fresh, they're extraordinary and they don't need anything else. But your caller's comment made me think of one very interesting little tidbit that I learned from this, putting together this volume. And that is that in Germany, they're doing experiments with cockroaches, trying to attract them and then poison them, obviously, because no one likes cockroaches. So they used a sugar solution. But what they found is that within 5 years, which is roughly 25 generations of cockroaches, they're losing their taste for the sweet because they are understanding that it is tainted with poison. So if you take the cockroach as an example, we can lose our sweet tooth too.
If we keep poisoning ourselves, I don't know if that's a good trade-off.
Yes. Well, yeah, I mean, in a way we are, just from the ubiquity of sugar in our food system.
So maybe five generations from now, Americans will be eating right. that sugar? I don't know. Well, I wanted to ask you, you know, I have heard anecdotally that American sweets are very, very sweet. And I've heard the same thing about other cultures, but that if you look, say, at the patisserie of France, that there's not really as much sugar in what we consider their sweets. Are there cultural differences in what a culture considers sweet?
Yes. And there are individual differences, too. I mean, everyone tastes differently. And once again, I think that the American palate has grown progressively more attuned to the sweet. Certainly in our candies and our chocolate, it's only, I think, fairly recently that as a country in general, we're starting to understand how beautiful a very dark and bitter sweet chocolate is. One of the things about sweets is that they will taste best when you add some salt to them, because that enhances the flavor. So that is one reason why you see things like salted caramel, and then you get some nuance and some complexity, and it's not simply just sweetness.
We heard from Carlos in Madison called, couldn't stay on the line, bringing up the connection between our sugar consumption and diabetes. We've alluded to some of the health problems, but lately we hear phrases like diabetes epidemic in the United States. I mean, is that the end result of our love of sugar, our mass production of refined sugar?
Unfortunately, I think it is. Again, I want to stress that I think the problem lies in processed foods and how many added sugars and the fact that they're very refined sugars. So if we decide that we want something sweet or we bake something at home and it has some sugar in it, that's not the problem. It's the amount of high fructose corn syrup, for instance, that sneaks into all kinds of food that is very common in the American marketplace, and people aren't really aware of how much sugar they're eating.
You're talking things like ketchup there and spaghetti sauce, that sort of thing.
Yeah, but even, you know, I think the two huge culprits in American life are children's breakfast cereals, which are enormously sweet and marketed in a way to appeal to children. And then also sodas, which, as we know, they were once made with cane sugar. And if you go to other parts of the world, they're still made with cane sugar, things like Coca-Cola, and they have this lovely flavor. But the processing changed here because it's cheaper now. So that's really, I think, where the problem is.
And just very briefly, as we wrap up, Dara, you've written this entire compendium on sugar and some of the glories along with some of the low points. I mean, would you want to live in a world completely without sugar?
Oh, never, never, never. sugar is a beautiful thing. It is just that when it's abused, like anything else, it can be dangerous. But I guess I would encourage listeners to think about all of the extraordinary works of art that have been created that show still life with all kinds of dessert tables, or chocolate being used as a medium by an artist like Ed Ruscha, or some of the dresses that they make for the Salon du Chocolat that are quite whimsical and wonderful. And the songs, all of the songs that have sweets in it.
We'll leave it there, Dara. Thanks for being with us today. That was food writer Dara Goldstein. Her new book, she edited the Oxford Companion to Sugar and Sweets.